Oh, mistress mine, where are you roaming? Oh, mistress mine, where are you roaming? Oh, stay and hear your true love's coming. Oh, stay and hear your true love's coming, that can sing both high and low. Trip no further, pretty sweeting, journey's end in lover's meeting, every wise man's son doth know. Trip no further, pretty sweeting, journey's end in lover's meeting, every wise man's son doth know. What is love? 'Tis not hereafter. What is love? 'Tis not hereafter. Present mirth hath present laughter. Present mirth hath present laughter. What's to come is still unsure. In delay there lies no plenty, then come kiss me, sweet and twenty, youth's a stuff will not endure. In delay there lies no plenty, then come kiss me, sweet and twenty, youth's a stuff will not endure.
Well, youth might not endure, but Shakespeare clearly does 400 years after his death. And as I said, there are a few people who know more about music in Shakespeare's plays than Christopher Wilson, who joins us now from the BBC in Hull. Christopher, welcome to the music show.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That was Roderick Williams singing O Mistress Mine, a song from Twelfth Night. What do we know about how songs such as that would have been sung in the context of Shakespeare's plays at the time?
A beautiful song by a contemporary, Thomas Morley, although probably not part of the first performance of Twelfth Night. Shakespeare uses music and songs from the Elizabethan age in a huge variety of ways. O Mistress Mine is what we now call a called for song or a formal song. In other words, they're prepared, they are inserted into the text as a separate entity, although surrounded by the dramatic dialogue, so they fit. They're not an oral distraction or an entertainment. Shakespeare's very clever in the way he integrates music and songs. But something like O Mistress Mine, what happens is that Sir Andrew and Sir Toby, they want Feste, who is the professional musician in Twelfth Night, to sing them a song. And he says, well, do you want a song, a proper song of the good life, in other words, the Puritan life, or do you want a song of pleasantness, of lust, really? And of course, they go for the latter. And O Mistress Mine is all about that. And you get songs in the plays where they as it were, formally introduced, like in the Tempest. There's five formal songs in the Tempest. In Henry VIII, for example, Queen Catherine calls for a lute song, as we now call them, songs accompanied by lute, as you heard in that performance. What happens is she calls her serving wench, as she calls him, her serving lady, to sing her a song to help her get over the terrible predicament she's in, not to lighten her mood, but to assuage her terrifying mood. And she asks her lady to sing a song, and it's this wonderful song called Orpheus with His Lute. And you get these songs throughout the plays. And nearly all the plays have songs. In the Comedy of Errors, some of the early plays don't have any formal songs, but all the plays have references to music. The other kind of songs that Shakespeare's very introduces in the plays are what we now call popular songs. These include street ballads, improvised ballads, non-notational ballads, other ones that aren't written down, what we sometimes refer to as folk songs. And he adapts them in the most wonderful ways to integrate them. There's the songs, the so-called mad songs in Hamlet, which Ophelia sings, so-called spontaneous or impromptu songs, where the text is given or even just alluded to in the plays, in the printed plays. There are hundreds of these references, and some are fully used, fully exploited, as in the Ophelia. And of course, Desdemona's Willow Song in Othello is a reference to a popular song.
Perhaps I'm asking you to guess here, but what do you think Shakespeare intended musically? I mean, I assume he wrote the words to these songs, the lyrics, as it were, for O Mistress Mine, for example, or Full Fathom Five, which we'll listen to in a moment. But did he have tunes in mind, do you think?
Possibly. I mean, there's even a discussion now, a theory that actually Shakespeare may not have written all the song lyrics, that the actors might have introduced them, songs that they knew. But some of the songs that are integrated in the drama, especially the ones in The Tempest, Shakespeare must have written the lyrics for those. Whether he had a tune in mind, I don't know, because the tune is not essential. It's not the actual music that's crucial. It's more the fact that it's the kind of song, that it's a solo song, possibly accompanied, possibly not accompanied. These are the crucial points to be made. I mean, the Morley, for example, has become famous now, and you can hardly imagine O Mistress Mine without the Morley tune, but it doesn't really fit the lyrics, the scansion of the song, but that doesn't really matter.
You're listening to The Music Show on RN. I'm talking to Professor Christopher Wilson, who's an authority on music in Shakespeare. Music in the Elizabethan time was often made people sad. I mean, lots of things made Elizabethans sad, and they enjoyed the feeling. But Shakespeare refers to this, doesn't he? He has Jaques say, "I can suck melancholy out of a song as a weasel sucks eggs." Yeah. And Jessica in The Merchant of Venice says, "I'm never merry when I hear sweet music." And then there's the famous sonnet as well, "Music to Hear, Why Hear'st Thou Music Sadly?" Is this something which is important, do you think, in terms of thinking about music in Shakespeare's plays?
Yes, it is pervasive. I mean, there's the two sides of music, which we still have today. Music can make you feel happy, and that's one of the references in The Tempest, sweet music, pleasing music. And there's music that can make you feel what... There was an Elizabethan concept, a mood called melancholy. Mm. And there was one very famous composer in Elizabethan times and a lutenist called John Dowland, whose whole musical persona was melancholy. Doulans, and his whole second book of airs, which was published round about the turn of the century, and which Shakespeare almost certainly would have known about, evinces melancholy. It's all about sadness. And there's this strange phenomenon in music that certain major keys, the sort of bright keys, can make you feel happy, and the minor keys, the dark keys, can make you feel sad. And this was a sound that the Elizabethans certainly exploited. And yes, I mean, melancholy could be exploited in differing ways. I mean, Falstaff feels melancholy. He's in a very bad way. And of course, music he's likened to a bagpipe and melancholy sounds. And at the opening of Twelfth Night, if music be the food of love, play on. That strain again, it had a dying fall. This is all about melancholic music and also about lustful music. Music be the food of love. Orsino is asking that music play to symbolise his love and his want for love.
Let's just pause and have another song on one of Shakespeare's great song lyrics. This is from The Tempest, Full Fathom Five.
Sing him softly, ring his bell.
Alfred Deller singing Full Fathom Five from Shakespeare's The Tempest with Desmond Dupre playing the lute. You're listening to The Music Show on RN, and I'm speaking to Christopher Wilson, Professor Christopher Wilson from the University of Hull, about music in Shakespeare. There is all sorts of music in Shakespeare's plays, from the humble fanfare through to quite complex songs. Is it part, as far as Shakespeare is concerned, is this part of the entertainment that he's providing, or is the music there for dramatic purposes mostly?
Yes, well, it's both. Though Shakespeare never uses music purely as entertainment, it always has significance. Even the Page's song in As You Like It, It Was a Lover. Yes, we need to mention instrumental music, because the cues, generally performed by trumpets. And now, trumpets in the Elizabethan age were not what we call art music instruments, although they were soon to become art music instruments in Venetian opera. But they were really signalling instruments. So they were a very useful way of bringing on a character and also exiting a flourish. And they signalled the arrival of someone of a note of some importance. And there were different trumpet signals. The basic one was just the flourish. This is the sort of general one, you know, the trumpets would play some sounds. They even used the trumpet. In Shakespeare's day, they had a trumpet in the tower in the Globe, and that trumpeter played to signal the actual start of the play. But once, when the play was running, they would signal the entries and exits of important people by a trumpet flourish. Now, there were, as I say, different kinds of trumpet calls, and this is what's so interesting, because Shakespeare obviously knows the significance of these, sometimes called a tucket, which is a cavalry signal and used to accompany an important person. And then at the beginning of the 17th century, the Senate came in from Italy, and it was a trumpet signal that was really reserved for people of the highest importance, military generals and for nobles and kings. And Shakespeare integrates these in a very dramatic way, so we're never left in doubt the importance of a person coming on stage. By all accounts, the Elizabethans liked noise. And so we extend music to include all the ordnance, the cannons being fired off and drums. Drums were used, of course, for the infantry. And Shakespeare used the drum very effectively throughout his play, both the military drum and the more domestic drum, the so-called tabor. The opening of The Tempest, for example, with the storm, was done by very clever means, by noise-making machines. They used to hollow out a log and roll a cannonball down to make thunder and lightning. And the Elizabethans rose to this, and they went to the playhouses to be entertained, but also to be challenged in their understanding of what was going on. So music, in its widest sense, is used most effectively by Shakespeare at all different moments in the play.
Presumably, the fact that these are outdoor performances, or at least there's no lid on the Globe, they're also noisy from that point of view, and so the odd tucket or two is important to sort of punctuate the drama and to call attention to it.
Yes, well, you see, he uses things like cries and alarums and excursions and all rushing about. In a battle, obviously, you can't have huge armies on stage, but what you can do is create the atmosphere of a battle. And this is sometimes referred to as the music of war. And Shakespeare uses this in many differing ways, obviously in the history plays, which are generally thought not to contain much music. But actually, when you look at them in more detail, references to music pervade these plays. And the music of war, the cries, the alarms, the drums. I mean, even just Shakespeare says, I can hear a drum afar off. Well, that could be a drum that's being played behind the tiring house at the Globe, you know, off stage, so to speak. Or under the stage, they use squealing oboes in Antony and Cleopatra to bring up this atmosphere. But it's important to note that Shakespeare never uses music in what we do today, in a sort of filmic underscoring. There's only one moment, I think, which we can possibly describe as music underscoring. That's towards the end of Richard II, where Richard is contemplating his ruinous life, what's all gone wrong in his life. And there's a wonderful musical metaphor. And there are also some stage directions to suggest that music plays at one point and then stops playing. But Shakespeare never uses music, as it were, to underscore the text. He uses it in a dramatic, significant function. So the sort of filmic productions of Shakespeare, which predominant today, actually are not really using music as Shakespeare intended.
I'm sure they're not doing a lot of things that Shakespeare intended. Christopher Wilson, thank you very much indeed for talking to me on the Music Show. It's gone too quickly, but it's been a great pleasure to talk to you. Professor Christopher Wilson is from Hull University, and he's written a number of books about this subject. His latest is Shakespeare's Musical Imagery, and we will put on our website a link to that.
Take all my loves, my love, yeah, take them all. What hast thou then, my love, thou hast before? No love, my love, that thou mayst truly love. This more. Then if for my love thou my love receivest, I cannot blame thee for my love thou usest. But yet be blamed if thou thyself deceivest by willful taste of what thyself refusest. I do forgive thy robbery, gentle thief, although thou steal thee all my poverty. And yet love knows it is a great offense to bear love's wrong and lathen injury. Lascivious grace in whom all ill will shows. Kill me with spites, yet we must not.